disarmament monitoring in exchange for a suspension of sanctions. And lifting would have to be later down the road. But we still say that this suspension of sanctions and eventual lifting of sanctions can only be possible in the context of implementation of the Security Council resolutions. As far as the basic goals are concerned, no weapons of mass destruction for Iraq, no missiles with range more than 150 kilometers, no threat from Iraq to its neighbors, etc., etc. Those are the overwhelming goals. The means are disarmament monitoring. No one is challenging. And Ivanov, our minister, said just yesterday, once again, that we are not considering in any way unilateral withdrawal from the sanctions. Sanctions could be suspended and then lifted in the context of implementation of the resolutions. So this is as far as our economic interest is concerned. But it is our position on Iraq is certainly more comprehensive than just the desire to resume economic ties which are beneficial to both countries, no doubt about it. And we are interested in the period after sanctions when we will be able to resume our economic cooperation with Iraq, be it oil exploration, be it trade. But there is also security concerns and political concerns of Russia. We are very close to the region, and we have interest in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East, including economic interest in our relations with other countries. We have been developing economic relations with Kuwait, with United Arab Emirates, not to mention traditional partners in the Middle East. Syria, Egypt, you name it. But the Persian Gulf countries, with which the Soviet Union had little relations, are more and more developing bilateral ties with Russia. So for this reason, and also for the reason of our geopolitical stability, we need stability in the Persian Gulf. And our latest proposals, which we have been promoting since last fall, clearly link the progress in Iraq, in Iraqi settlement, with the need to normalize the situation in the Gulf, which must include normalization of relations between Iraq and Kuwait, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and some regional approach to confidence building, mini OSCE process, if you wish.
So you see it as still as a central issue in the whole complex of the...
Absolutely. And of course it is linked to the Middle East settlement in a way, but in a very direct way. 687, paragraph 14, famous paragraph 14, speaks of the Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
And it's something which Egypt, when it was in the Security Council, always insisted upon it. And then through this aspect, you get into the substance of the problems in the Middle East settlement, and the substance of the problems which take place in the occupied territories, in Lebanon, and
there's a question, again, perhaps a delicate question, I'd like to pose. Ritter makes many accusations, but one of them is that Madeleine Albright was, in fact, instrumental in discouraging Butler from making too intrusive inspections. And I wondered, was there conversations between Russia and the United States which perhaps did in fact help persuade Madeleine Albright that the inspections were overly aggressive?
Well, we have been having regular contacts with Madeleine Albright and with Bill Richardson after her, and with Ambassador Peter Burley, who unfortunately left before the service, and regular contacts with Iraq being on agenda always. And we have been, raising the issue regularly about the manner in which inspections were conducted. We were not challenging the right of us going to visit any site. There was an exception for presidential sites, but that was an exception basically acquiesced with by the entire Security Council.
Under AKS?
No. Presidential sites.
Well, they were the same. The AKS made the.
Yes, he made this June 1996 paper with Iraqis.
Regarding sensitive sites.
And then it was developed into the Memorandum of Understanding which Kofi Annan signed with Tariq Aziz in February 1998. So the presidential site's exceptional nature was recognized by the entire council in a way, because we did acquiesce. The Americans were not very happy after that visit by Kofi Annan. But eventually it was accepted that a delegation of the council would accompany ANSCOM experts to visit all the sites.
Right.
And the only dispute which remained was about whether this was a one-time operation or this would be repeated. But this is irrelevant for the purpose of our discussion. But we never challenged ANSCOM's right to visit any site, and we have been voting for many resolutions after 687, as late as 1998 itself, which were repeating the language which was saying any site, any person, any material, anywhere, anytime, etc. But then we were also saying that this very intrusive mandate should be implemented in a delicate manner. I mean, ANSCOM would very often go with surprise inspections on Fridays. And this was something which Iraqis protested about, saying that if they come on Friday, and ANSCOM was saying we do it on Friday because Friday is a day off in Iraq and we don't want to embarrass too many people. But then they were reporting that there was lack of cooperation, that they had to wait for 1 or 2 hours before they could get in, and Iraqis were saying that, you know, this is a holiday and you have only a god who doesn't understand English and who is a very, you know, low person, and he cannot do anything without getting instructions from his bosses, and bosses are resting, so before he can get through the hierarchy to the guy who has authority, it takes time. Then there were many instances when they were really acting in a very rude manner. Starting with their appearances, visiting sites not shaven in t-shirts, some of them wearing t-shirts with anti-Iraqi abusive language or pictures, being rude with lady secretaries in some offices, asking them to open up their purses, you know, with going through this. And this is documented, and not only by Iraqis who made some video things of this and circulated them, but also by some of the inspectors who quietly complained about this. So it was this type of things which we really were concerned about, and I think Americans at the end of the day understood that this was wrong. Originally, they didn't pay much attention, saying, well, this is a country under sanctions, Chapter 7. And, but then the Security Council, even in those Chapter 7 resolutions, repeatedly recognized the need to respect the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and later the dignity. Dignity was added exactly because of this ANSCOM experience. And then, I think it was Kofi Annan who said that this is not a factory. So, yes, we did discuss these things with U.S. During our regular bilateral consultations between the two missions. Frankly, I wouldn't know whether Madden O'Brien gave any signals to Butler for him to be less intrusive or more intrusive. We all talked to him, and we all conveyed our messages. I was clearly on instructions conveying repeatedly the need for his teams to be more polite, basically. I was also conveying some other ideas which we had on the basis of discussions with Iraqis, and when Iraqis expressed concerns to us that they cannot produce more than they produced, and unless Anscombe indicated to them what else specifically they want, this famous topic which we discussed already, this information sharing, as it was known. And we conveyed all these things to Butler, so I assume that Americans, as well as other P5 members and other members of the Council who had any feedback from their capitals on Iraq, would be doing the same. But whether what Madden O'Brien was conveying to him was an attempt to regulate the level of his intrusiveness,
that's an interesting point. In this connection, did you feel that under Butler, Anscombe did become overly, let's say, under the influence of Washington?
The events of December 1998, they speak for themselves. I mean, it's still to be denied by those who were involved that he did make this report, which was a trigger for the use of force. He did make it available to Washington before it was even sent to the press, and before anybody else on the Council read it. And the report clearly was used as a pretext for the strikes, as a reason for the strikes. And the order to get the planes in the air was made before the report was formally received in the Security Council. That's all I can say.
Why do you think the U.S. did that?
Well, it's not for me to judge the motivations, but it was no surprise to anyone that the U.S. had repeatedly, before that, made its position clear that they would not stop at using force if Iraq does not cooperate. So it was no surprise, that the U.S. Used force. It was the manner in which Anscombe acted, which really was not acceptable to many countries.
I want to go back just for a minute to the Secretary General's trip. First of all, did you encourage him and others? Really encourage him to go at that point, or as far as you could see, was this totally his own conviction?
Well, I think it was both. I believe by his political instincts and by the virtue of obligations of his office, he decided for himself that it would be something which this must be tried. But at the same time, he understood clearly that unless he gets support from the Security Council, at least agreement from the Security Council that he should go, and to achieve some agreement with them, this would be futile. So the visit was preceded by his coming to the Council, and he clearly did it on his own initiative when he first came and said, there is a crisis. Under the circumstances, as a Secretary General, I have some duties. And I believe that my duties require me to try personally to get involved and to try and solve them. And then he presented the outline of his mandate as he believed it was on the basis of existing resolutions. And then he met a couple of times with the P5, with the non-permanent members, and then he came to the Council when it was clear that the basic elements of the mandate were acceptable to everybody. But then there was an attempt to micromanage the mandate and to really start discussing commas and definite and indefinite articles in the language which was never voted. He himself read out, you know, some language which he modified on the basis of consultations. And then when this discussion started again, and it was really going into tiniest details of the text, which apparently would never be used in his conversations in Baghdad, it was one of the, maybe the only time when I saw him lose his temper, but lose his temper in a very dignified way. It never showed his face. Mm-hmm. He just got up and said, "Thank you very much, dear colleagues. I believe I got the sense of the house. I'm leaving tomorrow. Good luck." And he left us, you know, discussing those commas, tiny things. It was a very dignified and statesman-like approach. So yes, he certainly decided himself that he was. He certainly decided that he must get the Council's support, at least agreement for this trip. But he was clearly in the lead on what this support should look like. He himself presented the mandate, which he believed was the realistic and the right, and he eventually got the Council.
Mm-hmm. How did you judge the outcome?
Well, I think it was maybe even more than everybody's, than anybody's expectation was, had been. I hear some views that, well, it collapsed in August when this episode of Barry Kazin saying, "But we don't have any relations with Zanskom anymore," when this happened. But again, there are too many complications. I'm sorry, this episode about IAEA report and the failure of the Council to recognize that one file is closed, this happened in 1998, not in 96. So it was also, you know, working in the direction of building up Iraqi's irritation with lack of result. 98, and then Charles Dolfo was right, it was 98.
That's right.
I was mistaken. Mm-hmm. In 96 there was a previous report of IA which already made this statement that basically they can do the rest within monitoring system. But the attempt to adopt a resolution of the Council was made in July 1998.
And that's when Charles Dolfo says...
Absolutely. So, I'm sorry, you would have to correct it. But it just occurred to me that this was the first reason why Iraqis became more and more irritated, and then Butler's negotiations with them in August were aborted.
Right. I, as a kind of a final question, because you are so extraordinarily well briefed on this whole subject, what do you think the final result will be, which is, number one, this is, at least I think, the most effective disarmament that ever takes place. It may not have been totally successful, but many more arms were destroyed than were destroyed during the storm. The Security Council, in fact, had then a major disarmament role in this particular case. Do you think this has significance for the future?
Well, first I agree with you that the disarmament results should be really considered not from the point of view of 100% achievement of quote-unquote full cooperation, because the language itself was unprecedented.
Yeah.
And by the way, when I theoretically was meeting with Richard Butler one by one, and we were friends actually, when he was ambassador, and we remained friends when he was appointed. And it's still nothing personal. And theoretically, we would be meeting with him, ambassador Green Bar, and have a very private chat. And I would ask him, Richard, but you know, it was the time of euphoria, not just because the Iraqis' occupation of Kuwait was rejected by everybody and was not accepted by anybody and was outrageous, but it was also euphoria of end of communism and all these type of things, and those maximalist demands and the resolutions and maximalist language like full cooperation, 100%, whatever, they would never be, you know, the rule in any future disarmament exercise. And he recognized being a disarmament expert, and I asked him, look, you are a disarmament expert. Yeah, he was complaining that Iraqis are cheating. I said, look, you've been in the disarmament. Okay. All these monitoring mechanisms, bilateral between USSR and USA, multilateral in the context of the chemical convention, in the context of the biological convention, all these monitoring mechanisms take the longest time to negotiate because it is about cheating. Because disarmament would always involve an element of suspicion, because parties would like to be more protected than, you know, than is agreed upon. This is not to justify, but the entire history of disarmament negotiations shows that cheating is an integral part of thinking. That another part, another side might cheat, is always the concern of you.
That's right.
So to say that because they try to cheat, they are an outcast, then it's wrong. They made themselves an outcast when they invaded Kuwait, right? But to say that Iraq does not have legitimate security interests, and to deny that they cannot, given their surrounding, defend their security interests by conventional forces, and of course this is not to justify that they should have weapons of mass destruction, illegal. But I mean, then, if we recognize this legitimate security needs, then let's have a regional discussion. Let's promote some regional cooperation and confidence building, disarmament, security, reduction of armed forces, with guarantees of great powers. I mean, you name it, but to deny that they have legitimate security concerns when you call them cheaters, and to ignore the aspect of their security concerns when they do cheat, would be not very facile. So I don't think it would be repeated, this type of regime. I don't think it would be repeated ever. Because of what I said, it's not realistic to make this sort of demands. And if you read the following resolutions addressed to Milosevic, the Taliban, they're not that categorical. But what you said on the success of the disarmament exercise in Iraq, I subscribe. Sure, the fact that nuclear file has been closed quite some time ago, and Iraq cooperated, they never had any complaint vis-a-vis IAEA. Some people say, well, you cannot hide nuclear facilities. Therefore, Iraq just had to present them to inspectors and to close down whatever was not within IAEA standards and for peaceful uses of nuclear energy. The same is said about the reasons why the missile file was practically closed, except the lack of information on two missile bodies.
Right.
But the engines, as Butler himself testified in the council, have been all accounted for. So even if these two bodies are lying somewhere, there are no engines, according to existing data. So they also say that missiles, it is difficult to hide because you need silos, you need some special facilities to keep them, which are easily detectable by satellites, etc. And the relative progress in chemical file is also described by the fact that chemical weapons facilities are relatively sizable. While on biology, they say you can do it in any kitchen, therefore there is no progress, which is used as a proof that they are cheating. And they had the chance to cheat on everything else, they would have cheated. But because of the size of the production, it's only biology which they still keep very close. Well, there is some logic to this. Certainly nuclear weapons are much more visible than some kitchen production of biological agents. But you really have to address the problem from the point of view of the, and they come back to the original 6-8-7 goals.
Right.
Whether Iraq produces a threat. And if they still might have biological weapons, do they have the means to deliver those weapons? The answer is no. And I'm also very much concerned by the approach which Butler was taking, and in some of his reports he was saying that he cannot be sure that Iraq, when asked directly whether Iraq is still a threat to its neighbors from the point of view of weapons of mass destruction, and he said that he cannot be sure that Iraq, on the basis of what had been destroyed and what had not been yet clarified, he cannot be sure that Iraq doesn't have potential from the point of view of material potential and intellectual resources. This intellectual resources part should never have been mentioned by him, because he was in fact saying that as long as there are people in Iraq who know how, sanctions cannot be removed. So what is the way out? To wait until they're all dead? Or to put them all in prison and to guard them? You cannot deny any country which is developing its science and technology would have people who know how to make a nuclear weapon. Take Japan. But this doesn't mean that Japan must be sanctioned because they have the intellectual potential to produce it.
No. What it does suggest, though, and I think that's what you were suggesting, is that there remains a necessity for monitoring.
Absolutely.
That is your position.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. We are convinced that the worst outcome of the bombing in December 1998, provoked by Anscombe, was that we, since then, cannot bring inspectors back.
Right.
We would be, you know, the last one on this planet not to be interested in Persian Gulf being a safe place. We would be the last one to be willing to see the countries of the region possessing the weapons of mass destruction. So we are interested in making sure that Resolution 687 and subsequent resolutions are implemented. We don't know what happened on all those sites in Iraq. The UN doesn't know since December 1998. IAEA was there under regular inspections, visiting Iraq as member of IAEA, not as Chapter 7 country.
No, they were doing peace talks.
Yes, but still in their report they mentioned that of course this was just regular IAEA inspection and it was not under the Security Council mandate, which would have been broader, but they said that still they have not seen any evidence that any proscribed problems have been resumed. But the same, well, first we want to make sure that IAEA is able to monitor permanently, that the same would be the case for missiles, chemical and biological fires, that UNMOVIC should come to Iraq, should restore the monitoring system, should make sure that all those cameras which were installed, that they are operational. They should decide, having analyzed the situation, whether they need some more sites to be put under the ongoing monitoring system. But as soon as they report to the Council that, yes, we have deployed units in Iraq fully, we have restored the ongoing monitoring system, we have tested it, say, for 2 months, it is functioning, and we haven't encountered any problems in our relations with Iraqis, this report should be a trigger for suspending sanctions. And then the lifting should take place later when disarmament requirements, which are still to be specified, have been fulfilled. But last point on this scheme which we are promoting is that before we suspend, I mean, and for this ongoing monitoring must restart, maybe expand its strength, but before we suspend, there must be clarity what is the financial, what are the financial parameters of suspension. The current way of thinking US and UK is that basically you call it suspension but you keep the committee on sanctions which would give permissions. It's a very interesting point. When 1284 was negotiated, the French and us and Chinese tried to say that let's discuss and let's negotiate the financial modalities, because you cannot keep escrow account, which means that Iraq does not have any access to its own money and it's only through the escrow account and committee on sanctions that this money is being spent. And if you call this suspension, it will be just, you know, the change of terminology, not the change of substance. There is no incentive to that. So the French and us were saying that let's discuss some new arrangement which would involve reporting, providing trade statistics on the part of Iraq and on the part of its trade partners, but post factum, and in a way which would allow the United Nations to detect any violations, and of course keeping embargo on arms dealer supplies to Iraq, but making all economic non-dual use items, dual use would still be under certain export-import control mechanism, but all the rest should be just subject to regular dealings with Iraqis receiving cash and Iraqis using this cash to buy, I mean, receiving cash for the royal and using this cash to buy non-dual use, non-military goods, but with all countries being obliged to provide statistical trade statistics on their trade with Iraq.
In effect, the embargo would be suspended.
Yes. If need be, we were saying with the French, let's have control on the borders, international monitors on the borders, anything, but there must be the real incentive for it. And they must know that suspension would mean suspension, not just keeping the same mechanism in place under a different name. But then we come back to the issue whether it would be ever possible for the Americans to accept suspension, real suspension, as long as current government is
right. In effect, that's the situation. System is almost in effect now because of the sanctions. They can sell as much arms as they want.
Well, in a sense, yes. And we have been making this point while we try now. Actually, this week, last week, we tried again to convince P5 to say that we have to start. P5 is a traditional part of the Security Council, which initiated many things on Iraq.
Yeah.
And we said that we just came to, it's almost 2.5 years that Anscombe left, and this was disbanded since, and Unmovic was created, but 2.5 years there is no monitoring in disarmament theory now.
You are one of the P5s, one of the very important P5s. And there really are two issues which have, I think, caused the unity among the P5 to disintegrate. One of them is this, the other is Kosovo.
And Kosovo is no longer a divisive issue.
No longer, but it was.
It was, of course.
And now that the United Nations has the BFAP of Griffith agreed to what the United Nations.
Well, we still have differences on, you know, whether to have elections in November or early next year, but those are tactical things.
Right. But my question is really more a political science question. How significant is this in terms of the future functioning of the Security Council? I mean, there was the great expectation during the Halcyon days that the unity had been restored and that the Security Council was an effective decision-making body. This was somewhat fractured by the Iraqi experience, especially related to sanctions, and also Kosovo. Now, if in fact the, as you say, the Kosovo has been overcome, and if the Iraqi problem is overcome in one way or another, do you think that this, that the Council can become a very effective organization?
Yes, I do think it's possible, and actually on quite a number of other issues, the Council is acting effectively, at least in what concerns reaching consensus on paper. Sometimes this consensus is papering over differences. For example, on African peacekeeping, where there is a very strong pressure on the part of Africans to have more peacekeepers in DRC and Sierra Leone. Well, in Sierra Leone, actually, we are having more peacekeepers. But there is also concern on the part of other members of the Council that we would be sending people in harm's way in the absence of actual compliance of the parties on the ground with their own commitments. But this would inevitably be present in any dealings of any international institution, but the Council has been efficient on quite a number of things. A part of those two we should quote. On Kosovo, my expectation is that we are moving in the right direction. And yes, if we manage to overcome the Iraqi deadlock and find some common ground, there would be no single issue which would be unsurmountable for the Council to move forward. But I would like to make one point. Indeed, Kosovo and Iraq were the two issues which prevented the P5 cooperation in the Council, which prevented Russian-American cooperation on global issues, and which prevented the Security Council from playing its role.
That's right.
But in both cases, the problems started because Kosovo was not originally a problem. The former Yugoslavia, the Balkans, was subject of consensus in the Security Council before and during Dayton, after Dayton. And Iraq was not a problem originally for the P5 unit. So in both cases, the problem started basically in the same at the same time, December 1998 and on January or
yes,
February 1999. Right?
In both cases,
the problem started because of unilateral actions outside the Security Council. In case of Iraq, it was UK and US use of force. In case of Kosovo, it was NATO use of force, both outside the Security Council. In both cases, there was a report which triggered and which was used as justification. In the case of Iraq, it was Butler's report. In the case of Kosovo, it was Ambassador Walker's report, who was head of OSCE mission and who came to Racak massacre spot next morning, and who declared on the spot that that was a genocide act, and he withdrew his mission, which he didn't have the right to do, because the OSCE missions are decided by consensus and he must have reported to the Permanent Council. By the way, we still try to get the report which the Finnish forensic experts made at the request of EU on Racak massacre. The content of this report was leaked last May, almost a year ago, in the German press and later in the Japanese press. And the newspapers assert that what they have seen does not contain the proof that that was a massacre, that most of the bodies found were killed in action. When we read this, we asked the secretary to give us the report, and we have exchanged about 5 letters with them. The state of the play now is that we were informed that the report had been submitted to Carlo Del Ponte in The Hague, and that Carlo Del Ponte, in response to the secretariat's request to provide this report for the Security Council members, said that she cannot provide the full report, she can only provide a summary, which we didn't accept, and we said, look, first, the tribunal is a subsidiary body of the Security Council. Second, Racak was the trigger for NATO action, for the mobilization of public opinion in the West in support of NATO action. So we do have the legal and moral right to read this report, and we still don't get an answer. So my point, answering to your question, in both cases there was a unilateral action which undermined the unity of the Security Council and of the people. Right. In Iraq, before December 1998, on most occasions, we have been, as Russia, if not on all occasions, we have been joining consensus, yes, after laborers negotiations, after give and take, after being accused that we are trying to protect Saddam Hussein, while we were trying just to avoid the language which would be used later to justify the use of force. But still, there was always possibility to reach consensus. And had Butler not presented 5 tiny cases out of 400 to justify the lack of full cooperation, I am sure that the cooperation on Iraq and the joint pressure on Iraq of the entire people would have continued. In Kosovo, just before Racak, end of 1998, there was a problem of OSCE mission getting some protection unit. We were considered, as Russia, we were considered by the West as being totally against giving any arms, even light arms, to OSCE mission, because Yugoslavs were against it. But I can assure you that had the attempt been made to continue pressing this point in the Security Council, Russia would have eventually joined consensus, even giving some military units to support the OSCE mission. And I can assure you that it would have been possible to persuade Belgrade to accept it. But it would have taken time. Well, that's, I cannot produce any proof because history does not allow this, but that was, but my point is that it is undisputable that in those cases it was a unilateral action which...
Right, and from that I deduce that this is beyond our conversation here, but your views are important to me. That basically you're not pessimistic about the future of the Security Council.
Well, I still have about, well, I hope not less than 10 years to go before my retirement. So yeah. I cannot be pessimistic about my job. Well, yeah. not necessarily here, but in diplomacy.
That's a broader field. You've got to go.
Yes, I do.
I have to teach tonight, and I have to teach a simulation on...
What time is your class?
6:30.
On 20 minutes to go.
Yeah.
Is it in Yale?
No, it's here in Manhattan. It's a graduate course I teach here. It's a simulation on Kashmir.
Oh, quite topical.
Quite topical, and one that I'm...